You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. America celebrated its 244th birthday on Saturday, but the party was muted in part by recent protests over racial injustice and violence. Coming up, we look at what our guest calls the American contradiction, that a nation conceived in liberty was born with many in shackles. Now, in March of 1953, poet and activist Langston Hughes testified in front of the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations on Un-American Activities. Chaired by Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy, the committee had subpoenaed people from many walks of life, but the American creative class was under particular scrutiny. This episode in Hughes' life is the focus of playwright Carlisle Brown's piece, Are You Now or Have You Ever Been? And it's one of the plays that American Players Theater in Spring Green chose for a staged reading that was recorded over Zoom. Thanks to our colleagues at PBS Wisconsin, it and the other five authorings in the Out of the Woods series are available for free online through July 26th at pbswisconsin.org. Gavin Lawrence is an actor, director, playwright, and composer. He's been part of APT in Spring Green since 2016, joining as a member of the Core Acting Company in 2019. He's a member of Actors Equity Association and the Union of Professional Actors and Stage Managers. He plays Langston Hughes in APT's reading of Are You Now or Have You Ever Been? Gavin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, Rob.
Well, you've been so closely connected to this historical figure, Langston Hughes. This isn't the first time you've played him. Can you tell us, remind us a little of the outline of his life and work?
Well, Langston Hughes, he was born in Joplin, Missouri, and traveled a lot as a young child, ended up in Mexico as a young man with his father who wanted him to become a lawyer or an engineer. But he had another kind of desire, which was to write. And he ended up leaving Mexico at a young early 20s and moving to Harlem in New York at a time when Harlem was starting to bubble with what became later known as the Harlem Renaissance. And it was during this period in the 20s into the mid 30s that he was the most prolific in terms of his poetry, his novels. He wrote a column for the Chicago Defender. And it was also during this period where a lot of his writings started to turn some people in another direction. Some people were very appreciative of his writing because he wrote deeply in the African-American vernacular. And then there were other writers and artists at the time who wanted us to sound more like what Americans thought we should sound like. And so he was kind of this dividing figure. He and Zora Neale Hurston both tended to write in our own vernacular. And so a lot of African-American artists didn't appreciate that, but it actually became what he was known for and is, to me, like one of his most lasting legacies.
In the talk back after the APT online performance, the playwright Carlisle Brown had this to say about Langston Hughes.
You know, as an African-American writer, you know, he's one of my predecessors. You know, there is like a kind of lineage of, you know, African-American literature, which maybe African-American writers might look at in a different way than, you know, other people do. But, you know, he is. So, you know, whenever you're going to start on that journey, you're going to know about people like him and, you know, intimately and study their writing and sort of whatever. So how it came together, all I know is that I wanted to write a play that worked like a poem, and then I wanted creativity to be a character.
Now, you're an actor who's played Langston Hughes. You're a playwright yourself. Do you have similar feelings about Langston Hughes as someone who's influenced your own creativity?
Oh, absolutely. When I was a young boy, my mother, who was a literature professor at Howard University, would have me recite Langston Hughes poems. So he's been in my blood for a very long time. And then when I had the chance to portray him in this play that Carlisle wrote twice in Minneapolis, and then for this most recent reading at APT, I felt not only honored to get to play him, but I felt like I was given a huge gift, especially given the current climate in our country, to have more people know him, know his work, and hear his voice.
This is a unique play. It's a one-act play, but it's kind of in two parts. The first part is all you. It's all Langston Hughes talking, not just about what he's about to do in front of this Senate committee, but about creativity and the state of African-American literature. Yeah. What's it like? It seems like a demanding role.
It is very demanding. I can't tell you how relieved I am when we get to the second part where I have other people to share the stage with. Most actors would enjoy being on stage by themselves for that long, but he has so much to say. And it is like two separate shows, actually. But it's a wonderful challenge. And again, I think the audience, most Americans don't know about Langston Hughes. I think like they should. And so to get a chance to trace his life, to trace his feelings about art and literature and fiction, particularly, and then to get to see how he's kind of like raked over the coals for being an artist, I think is very ironic and symbolic of what we're dealing with now.
Talking to Gavin Lawrence, actor and playwright. He's part of American Players Theater in Spring Green. He's playing Langston Hughes in their virtual performance that you can watch at pbswisconsin.org of this play, Are You Now or Have You Ever Been? Talk about this confrontation, Gavin, of you as Langston Hughes and this and Senator Joe McCarthy's committee.
Well, you know, they at that point the committee was under a lot of pressure to try to appear more congenial and not so dictatorial. And so they made an agreement with Langston Hughes that he would be a cooperative witness. However, there were two sessions. One was a closed session and the other was a public hearing where they got to make it seem as though they weren't as bad as many people thought they were. But they were trying to get him to basically admit that he was a communist. And so he had to kind of dance around that, because although he did at different points in his life have connections with people who were supposedly members of the party and at one point believed in some of their philosophies, he never joined the party. But they really wanted him to not just denounce the party, but to kind of champion what at that point would be called American democracy as opposed to communism. So he's dancing verbally throughout the second half as best as he can, until they basically let him off the hook.
I want to give a listen to, now this is back in part one of the play, and it kind of follows what we heard earlier from playwright Carlisle Brown about creativity as a character. This is you as Langston Hughes. Let's give a listen.
Look, what I am trying to say to you is that fiction is essential. It is not frivolity, it is not entertainment, it's not just the way you pass through leisure moments in your life. It is life. Stories are the keys to life. They are the means to our survival, roadmaps into our very being. Why? Because we cannot do this alone. We must have some record of those who have gone before us. Otherwise, we're just treading water, spinning our wheels all over and over again. The future is where stories lead, spreading throughout the world. Oh, to see the future, to know it, to believe in it, to stand in a place where it will make you safe, and safe for the generations that follow behind us, fiction is essential.
Now, the power of storytelling there, Gavin, and as, you know, we're isolated at home a lot of the time, as we see protests out there, it seems, I don't know, that seems like an even more striking and important passage in some ways. What do you think?
Absolutely. You know, it's such beautiful writing and so on point. But we are, you know, we are hungry for creative expression. We are hungry, I think, as a society, to have our experience reflected back to us, you know, and I think that what Langston Hughes says is absolutely true, that fiction is essential. And without it, we are basically isolated without any connection to the past or the future.
As we wrap up, I want to talk to you. You've played this role on stage, and now you've played it on a screen, or computer screens, watching at home. This actually worked out really well for staging, because the first half is Langston Hughes kind of in his office, basically, so it's like you're working at your desk, and then it's like a Zoom meeting in the second half. Now, can you talk about the staging and what that was like?
Oh, absolutely. Well, our director David Daniel did a really great job of juxtaposing my physical image on screen with the words and lyrics of a lot of Langston Hughes's poems, which, as Carlisle wrote in the stage directions, is vital to how he wanted this piece to be produced. And so to get a chance to see what he did, I haven't seen it yet. I guess I'll see it soon. I heard it really worked well for this format, and that when we get the other guys from the McCarthy committee, Dirksen and Cohn and Shine, that seeing these guys in these different squares actually made the audience feel as though they were watching a hearing. So I think it really worked well on this platform.
Gavin, thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Gavin Lawrence is a member of the core acting company of American Players Theater in Spring Green. He plays Langston Hughes in APT's reading of Are You Now or Have You Ever Been? Thanks to our colleagues at PBS Wisconsin, APT's Out of the Woods series of staged readings, including this play, is available at pbswisconsin.org. Coming up, a pilot project to save chimney swifts in Wisconsin involves a survey for people about the state of their chimneys. We'll find out how you can help this bird. Stay with us here on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest wants to know about the state of your chimney, if you have one, and whether it might be the next home for a family of chimney swifts. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the return of live music.
Music stages across Wisconsin have been silent since March as the pandemic forced venues to close. This has moved artists to Facebook and other virtual stages. Now, some venues are starting to bring back live music with smaller audiences and precautions in place. Andy Turner visited the Jazz Estate in Milwaukee recently for its reopening.
It's Friday night, and live music is back at the Jazz Estate on Milwaukee's east side. The lights are low, the bartender is pouring drinks, and the band is warming up. But some things are different. There are fewer patrons, and they're all wearing masks, the new required attire. Owner John Dye has been waiting for this night.
A lot of people get their start with live music. A lot of musicians meet with live music. I mean, it really represents more than just an individual show. It's a whole system.
Bars and restaurants are slowly reopening. In mid-June, the Jazz Estate was operating at 25% capacity for the show, which meant only 16 people could be in the venue, including staff and band members. Tickets were $44.
Really, for tonight's show, we're actually only selling 7 tickets. But we figure bringing the music to people is worth it. So it's just something we have to adjust to and hope that it goes to 50% soon.
Dye says he spent the last few weeks figuring how to comply with the requirements to make his venue as safe as possible. Milwaukee's Marcia Daniil Group is playing tonight. The show is also being streamed live on Facebook. The group was scheduled to play here before the pandemic. Marcia Daniil says it felt great to be back in front of a live audience and with band members she had not seen in months.
As musicians, we thrive off of the energy, you know, that we get from people in the audience, and we especially thrive off of the energy that we get from the people that we're on stage with.
Barbara Wanza of Black Arts MKE attended the show. She says she didn't plan on going out so soon after stay-at-home orders were lifted, but she wanted to support a friend who was performing. Wanza says paying higher ticket prices because of social distancing limitations does not bother her.
I think it could keep some people away. It would not keep me away personally. I'm a big supporter of local talent, especially local African-American talent. And, you know, I'd do just about anything to support them, as long as I can be safe.
Bartender Jeff Kinder admits it felt a little strange to be back behind the bar.
Just the vibe from other bartenders I've gotten on the block, it's everyone misses it, but it's just such a weird feeling re-entering this kind of work right now.
Despite that sense of weirdness, Kinder says he was happy to see some familiar faces and realize now how much he had missed certain aspects of his job.
When you shake a drink really good and you crack a tin open, you hear like, it's like these bubbles coming out of the tin. And it's hands down one of my favorite sounds in the world. You just know you did it right.
The economic fallout from the pandemic has hit Dye especially hard as the owner of two other establishments in Milwaukee, Brian's Cocktail Lounge and At Random. Dye says the Jazz Estate will continue having shows until it does not make sense to anymore.
But there's a little bit of it that's just bringing a service of bringing the music back. Obviously, this isn't really about any kind of profit or anything, though that is important, and not having that income is scary. But it's also important to have music and life and energy.
Dye says he knows how important venues like the Jazz Estate are for musicians. While restaurants, bars, and stores continue to reopen, many performance venues are likely to be among the last to reopen.
Andy Turner is a freelance journalist, college English instructor, and radio DJ living in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, if you live in or near a building with a brick chimney, you might be familiar with this sound. That rapid tweeting you're hearing isn't a savvy social media user. It's a slender acrobatic bird called the chimney swift. Swifts have been declining in number among several other insect-eating birds, according to the Wisconsin DNR. Loss of habitat, including suitable chimneys in which to nest, that's one possible concern. The DNR and the Wisconsin Chimney Swift Working Group are trying to gather info about the state's chimneys as they try to find some answers. Sandy Schwab is chair of that working group. Sandy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit. Give us some Chimney Swift 101 about this bird.
All right. Well, as you just mentioned, chimney swifts need our help. Many people are not even aware of swifts or think that they're swallows or bats. They don't perch like many of the common birds that we are accustomed to seeing. Swifts fly most of the day, sometimes really high in the sky, gathering insects in their open bills. They can eat about a third of their body weight in insects every day, which makes our summer evenings a little more enjoyable. So they're almost always in flight unless they are at the nest or in the roost at night. And they use their toes and their stiff tail feathers to cling to the inside of masonry walls of chimneys and other rough vertical surfaces, such as concrete silos. Now, you know, when we think about wildlife habitat, forests or parks or wetlands or even our backyards come to mind, but actually masonry chimneys are wildlife habitat for these birds. They're primarily dependent on these on our human structures for nesting and roosting, but many of the buildings that have masonry chimneys have been demolished to be replaced by structures that have modern heating systems that don't even include chimneys. The chimneys can also deteriorate over time, and homeowners may convert to a newer heating systems that don't use that traditional chimney, and it may be easier to remove that chimney rather than to repair it and keep it open for swifts.
And as I understand it, the swifts came to our chimneys because we got rid of a lot of the older growth trees that they used to count on. Is that right?
That's right. And even as early as the 1600s, there are records of swifts that had switched over to chimneys that of the settlers rather than the big hollow trees like sycamores that they were used to roosting and nesting in. Over time, it worked very well for them, but unfortunately now they're facing other challenges. And, you know, like their other challenges can be some of the problems that we see with intense storms during migration. When swifts migrate, they often migrate in big groups of thousands of birds. And if they hit an intense storm, they could all perish. Mm-hmm. There's also declining or changing aerial insect populations and habitat destruction, both in the U.S. and in their wintering grounds in South America, like the wildfires and just the destruction of the rainforests.
Well, that takes us to the survey. What are you trying to find out from people around Wisconsin?
We're trying to find out if there are chimneys in Wisconsin that are being used by swifts that also need repairs. And once we identify this need, then we are going to try to work with some funding sources and see if we can do some cost sharing as far as repair of these chimneys. Some people are now constructing freestanding chimney swift towers to replace the loss of the masonry chimney habitat. Paul and Georgine Kyle from Austin, Texas, have constructed many towers in their local conservancy, and they've had success with them. Unfortunately, we haven't had that same success in the Midwest, and we're not sure why. We know that the swifts nest one pair to a chimney, and they return to the same chimney every spring. They're used to living in our chimneys, and they may not be accepting of new structures that are unlike their usual habitat. So that makes it all the more important for us to save the chimneys that we now, that we know that are being used by Swifts.
So in our last minute or so, what would you ask of people, maybe homeowners who do have that kind of chimney that might be a Swift habitat?
Well, if they, we call them Swift landlords, if they have Swifts or if they're interested in Swifts, the main thing they can do is to keep that chimney open for Swifts. They should get their chimney cleaned every year after the Swifts leave for South America or before they return. And if they and also they can complete our survey. So we'd like to know about that.
Oh, and I should ask, how can people find that survey and participate?
Well, it's on the DNR website, but it's on their listserv, but it's also on your program, right? On your
We'll make sure we have a link to that over at WPR.org/Central Time. Sandy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you, Rob.
Sandy Schwab is chair of the Wisconsin Chimney Swift Working Group. We talked to her about a survey the group is conducting to help identify and preserve clean chimneys around Wisconsin. And then those chimneys can serve, as we heard, as nesting spots for chimney swifts. Again, you can find a link to that survey. We'll have that up over at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we'll look at the history of Independence Day and the birth of the United States and the role slavery played in both, and how our historical memory works and doesn't work when it comes to confronting the history of slavery. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show, there's a lot of interest in disinfecting surfaces lately and how to do that safely without overdoing it. Kate Archer-Kent talks to a biohazard cleanup expert who's been working on COVID-19 response. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, normally we celebrate Independence Day with fireworks, parades, big backyard barbecues, and other fanfare. But the coronavirus pandemic scrapped a lot of those fun traditions. Plus, the death of George Floyd and the protests and riots that followed make America's 244th birthday a little more somber. Our guest says this year it's all the more important to focus on what he calls the American contradiction. Kenneth C. Davis is a writer and historian. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series. His article, The American Contradiction, Conceived in Liberty, Born in Shackles, appeared in the March-April issue of Social Education. Ken, good to have you back with us today.
It is always a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Ken, I know you think about the history of a lot of different American holidays and how they've changed over the years. I know you've been thinking a lot about Independence Day, the 4th of July, lately. Can you talk about just what's been on your mind?
Well, first of all, my book, Don't Know Much About History, came out 30 years ago. It's hard for me to believe it when I say that, but it's true. And the fact is that I've been talking for all of those 30 years, almost every year on the 4th of July, about what this document means in our history, the Declaration of Independence. But this year is different. It's different, first of all, because of the pandemic. We are reexamining everything we do in our lives. But it's also, including the way we celebrate holidays, but it's also different because, as you mentioned, we are in the midst of this great reckoning over race and slavery. And this goes back to what you just mentioned, the article I wrote called The Great Contradiction, that we are a nation conceived in liberty but born in shackles. And I think that this year, more than any time that I've talked about this in the past, it's a very real thing, obviously, because of the protests in the streets. A few years ago, I wrote a book called In the Shadow of Liberty, It's the story of five people who were enslaved by presidents, including Washington and Jefferson, the two icons of American independence in many ways. And the fact that these men were enslavers has been left out of our history books for most of our lives. And it is that contradiction that we are facing very clearly right now. And it came up again when the president spoke in front of the Mount Rushmore last week, this notion that we have two histories. For most of my life, one history was left out, and we are confronting that history right now.
I'll say, as a school kid growing up, I think to sum things up, I would say I got kind of a sidebar history of slavery. Like, here's the important stuff. Here's the presidents. Here's the wars. And oh, yeah, and slavery was going on at this time. And you and other historians have been making the case that we need to wrap the history of slavery in as a crucial part, a part you can't leave out of American history. Can you talk about how we can do that?
Well, we have to start with looking at the foundational documents. For instance, we're talking about the Declaration of Independence on the 4th of July. And this is a document with timeless verities. All men are created equal. We are all endowed with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These are verities not only for Americans, but for all people. And they've been the most important thing that we do celebrate on the 4th of July. But in fact, Thomas Jefferson wrote a denunciation of slavery into his draft of the Declaration of Independence. It was removed. It was removed by men who owned slaves. It was removed by men who made a great deal of money transporting them. There was slavery in every one of the original 13 states. A little state like Rhode Island, the smallest state, had enormous wealth piled up by slave traders. Brown University a few years ago did a very deep dig into its history, the history of its founders and the men who endowed it as slavers. One of them was Stephen Hopkins, who is a signer of the Declaration of Independence. 40 of the 56 signers were enslavers. So it is wrapped up in our history. It comes back 11 years later when the Constitution is drafted in that same room in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787. And slavery was on the table. It was on the table constantly. And most of the large slaveholding states of the South, because some of the northern states had begun by then to move away from slavery, some of the large slaveholding states said they would just walk away from the table if slavery was not continued. It was not only continued, it was really cemented into the American system of government through something that we probably all learned about in sixth grade or maybe eighth grade called the Three-Fifths Compromise, which basically said that the enslaved population would be counted in the census to determine representation in Congress, and hence to determine how many seats you had in the so-called Electoral College. What does that mean in reality? Well, it meant that Virginia, which was smaller than Massachusetts or Pennsylvania if you counted the white population, had the largest population when you included the enslaved population, even at three-fifths of a person. So Virginia gets the most seats in Congress, the most electors, and four of the first five presidents are slaveholders from Virginia. It's not a coincidence. So this is the fact that this institution, they called it the peculiar institution, was not a sideshow to our history. It was a central act in the American drama, and we haven't taught that for 200 years, properly at least. And now is the great reckoning.
We're talking to Ken Davis, author of the Don't Know Much About History series, looking at Independence Day in the United States, what it means, and why he says we need to look at the role of slavery in early American history a lot more closely than we do, say, or have done in our schools. Ken, something that's getting more attention this 4th of July than I think it has in years past is the speech by Frederick Douglass, What to a Slave is the 4th of July. Here's a quote from that in 1852. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. And that's that two history concept you were talking about.
Absolutely. And of course, Frederick Douglass gave that address in 1852 in Rochester, New York. In the audience was the sitting president of the United States of America, Millard Fillmore. So this was pretty, talk about speaking truth to power. Fillmore, by the way, was the president who signed off on what became known as the Compromise of 1850. That was a series of compromises, actually, which allows certain states to come into the Union as either a slave state or a free state. And this was the great political argument of the day. It was really not a moral argument in 1850. It was really an argument about this political power that slavery endowed on the slaveholding states. And there was Millard Fillmore, and here's Frederick Douglass, a man who had escaped enslavement, a man who wrote about his master probably being his father, and how he had actually had a fight with that man at one point. Pretty dramatic stuff, the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass. And there he stands and gives this speech, which says that there's not a nation on earth that has a more bloody history. That is pretty strong stuff. And I was quite amazed. I've been talking and writing about Frederick Douglass's speech for quite a while. I was quite pleased and amazed to see how much attention it got this year.
We're talking about the founding of the United States and what our guest calls the contradictory birth of the U.S. Kenneth Davis is our guest. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in that series. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions or comments do you have about Independence Day? Do you think we need to talk and look more closely at America's history of slavery? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're looking at some of the truths, myths, and misconceptions about the founding of the U.S. and slavery's place in American history and how we teach about American history. Ken Davis is with us, author of the Don't Know Much About History series, among other books. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Ken about the history? Do you have thoughts on who we should honor from America's past and how we should do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jacob is with us in Madison. Jacob, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I've got a question for your guest, and forgive me if this was addressed already and I'm just tuning in. But how much was slavery a compromise in the founding of our nation? And what I mean by that is, it's my understanding that the slaveholding colonies wouldn't even come to the table and sit down to discuss forming a union, a new nation with the non-slaveholding colonies, if slavery was something that was on the table for discussion about whether or not it was going to be allowed or not. And so essentially, if slavery was up for discussion, the slaveholding colonies wouldn't even consider forming a union. And Jacob, so how much is that true?
Thanks a lot for the call. We started to touch on that. Ken, can you expand on that a little?
Yes, I'll quickly go back to that because I had mentioned, first of all of the 13 colonies were slaveholding, as I mentioned earlier. All 13 original states were slaveholding states. It was only Vermont, which comes in as the 14th state, that comes in as the first state without slaveholding. So this was absolutely part of the deal. And as I mentioned, Jefferson writes a stinging denunciation of slavery into the Declaration, his draft. It's removed by the Congress. Jefferson was not too happy about being edited at any rate, but certainly wasn't happy about this. But again, gets to the heart of the contradiction. How does this man write a denunciation of slavery into this Declaration of Independence and go home to this plantation utterly dependent upon enslaved labor? And of course, in his case, it becomes even more complicated because he fathers children with an enslaved woman. Sally Hemings, of course. And at the Constitutional Convention, as I mentioned, in 1787, slavery is certainly on the table. And as the caller right correctly mentions, some of those states by then were not slaveholding. Pennsylvania was the first to outlaw slavery in 1780. But this was an issue that was going to be a dividing point for these states, and they would not sign onto the Constitution without protection for slavery. Slavery is also protected because the federal government is committed to protecting the owners of the enslaved if there were runaways. Washington signs that into an actual law in 1793, the Fugitive Slave Act, which makes it a federal offense to assist a runaway. There was also a deal that there would be no laws made about slavery for 20 years from 1787, 1788 forward. And so the foreign slave trade is not ended until 1808. Many of those founders thought that the ending of the slave trade in 1808 would mean the end of slavery. It had almost the exact opposite effect because it increased the value of the enslaved population in the United States and made the production of slaves more valuable in a way as a homegrown product. I hate to say it, slave breeding became a very profitable enterprise in the first half of the 19th century in America.
I wanted to ask your thoughts, Ken, on who we memorialize. And this is something we're talking about a lot, obviously, with statues. If you get rid of Confederate leaders, do you have to reconsider, you know, George Washington because he owned slaves? Christine Emba, who wrote about this for The Washington Post, said, you know, the Confederate leader was known for one thing, the Civil War and secession. A George Washington or a Thomas Jefferson played huge, in some ways, in many ways, positive roles in American history, and they were slave owners. It's a little less cut and dry, she thought. What's your take?
I think it's a really important question that we should address. And in fact, I just wrote a piece on my own website, don'tknowmuch.com, about this called What Do We Do About George? Absolutely, the men who are the so-called heroes of the Confederacy, these generals for whom these statues went up, for the most part during the 1920s or the 1950s, when they were put up as an expression of white supremacy during the civil rights era, these men were dedicated to a nation that was completely built upon slavery. They had betrayed their country. They had betrayed their oath of office. They were traitors to America. So I think that's an important distinction to make, because when we're talking about Washington and Jefferson in particular, we're talking about the men who built the nation. And the two of them were probably the two most indispensable men when we think about America's independence. Yet, I do think that we have a balancing act. For most of the past 200 years, these men were presented as perfect marble statues, Washington in particular. And I think that it's the historian's job to present that balance and say, yes, he fought for liberty. He fought for America's independence while enslaving people, and including enslaving people who tried to escape from his own plantation to the British during the war. So I think it's time that we have a really serious conversation. And I suggest in my article that maybe we should drape that pristine white marble statue or monument in Washington on the Mall with a Black Lives Matter banner and really have this conversation, which we've avoided. Realistically, I don't think we're going to do that right now, but it still seems to me to be a very, very appropriate thing that this country should acknowledge and have a reckoning with. Just as South Africa, after apartheid ended, had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to really examine its past, I think that it would be very healthy for this country to do something similar.
Do you think, I mean, this has been a long time coming, just very briefly, Ken, do you think we have it in us to have that discussion, that confrontation?
Certainly not right now, given the state of the political atmosphere and the commentary that we hear coming from the president in this case. I mean, this is as far from a realistic opportunity as we can possibly be. So perhaps, you know, if the political situation, the landscape changes sometime in the near future, perhaps we have that conversation. But we're having that conversation in the streets right now. And there's no question about that, that the Black Lives Matter movement, in the wake of the death of George Floyd and others, has completely changed the landscape in a stunning way.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Ken Davis for being back with us, author and historian, author of Don't Know Much About History and much more. We talked to them about the history of Independence Day. Some restaurants are open again in Wisconsin after being closed during the pandemic, except for carryout service. As Shemaine Mills reports, not all restaurants are opening, even given the opportunity, and some are calling it quits.
Opening a restaurant is hard. The margins are thin, customer taste can be fickle. But closing a restaurant can be even more difficult, whether it's because of normal business cycles or a worldwide pandemic. The Wisconsin Restaurant Association estimates as many as 30% of eateries around the state which temporarily closed because of COVID-19 won't reopen. Restaurants were forced to close at the end of March in an attempt to contain the new coronavirus under the state's Safer Home Order. Christine Hilmer with the Wisconsin Restaurant Association said it was difficult because there wasn't time to plan.
When the crisis hit, people were pretty much forced to close down immediately. There was very little time to close down in a way that made sense. A lot of people still had food supplies. They had to figure out what to do and so on.
Some businesses, like Mana Cafe on Madison's north side, kept open to the extent they could during the shutdown. One hot day in June, customers waited outside for takeout in 88-degree weather for what they say is some of the best food in town. Big bags of food were brought out by a cafe manager who shouts the names of customers through a face mask.
Ryan. Ah, yes.
All right.
Thanks. See you next time.
That's Ryan Braithwaite, who says he ate at Mana Cafe at least once a week before it closed.
It's a Madison institution. The food is phenomenal. The staff is great. You know, I'm on a first-name basis with probably four or five people here. You know, it's a real shame.
With just a week to go before the final meal was served, staff were busy at Mana Cafe. Dishes from the lunch rush were being washed and counters cleaned. Barb Pratzel was putting away homemade bread as she recalls opening up the restaurant in 2005 with her husband, Mike.
I had a passion for baking and cooking that came out of my childhood and would bake all the time. And because my husband and I couldn't eat everything that I baked, I would bring this into work. People at work would say, oh my gosh, this is so good. You've got to go into business someday.
15 years later, the Pratzels are shutting down. Although they can now operate at a quarter their capacity, Barb isn't sure customers would come in like they did before.
We're crazy busy, packed every weekend. Well, it's going to be a long time till a restaurant is packed again. In order for us to get back to the kind of restaurant that we were running, there's an awful lot of time that has to pass.
Hilmer from the Restaurant Association agrees it may take time.
I am cautiously optimistic that we're through the worst of it, but we're still going to see folks that are just going to, you know, throw up their hands and say, we can't make it. We've lost too much ground.
Hilmer's extra federal unemployment will make it difficult to hire through July, and restaurants are spending more to keep everyone safe. Mana Cafe owner Barb Pratzel says some staff are afraid to come into work because of COVID-19. Others found different jobs. She tears up as she thinks about leaving her staff and her customers.
I'm proud that we've touched so many people's lives all over the state. You know, this thing that we've created here on the north side is not only a one-of-a-kind, but it's going to leave a big gaping hole in this community.
And retirement will be a big transition for the Pratzels, who love their work. But Barb says she's looking forward to having brunch with her husband in someone else's cafe where she's the customer. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Wisconsin has a backlog of unemployment claims since the beginning of a wave of job losses from the coronavirus pandemic. Workforce Development Secretary Caleb Frostman joins us with the latest. Gyms were closed for quite a while, and some people developed new at-home workouts along the way. We'll find out how people adapted and maybe get some healthy advice we can use. And there's a close connection between the way we grow our food and the wildlife that lives around it, especially when it comes to birds. We'll talk to the author of the book, In Search of Meadowlarks. That and a look at some of the top news stories of the day coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, how much screen time is too much for kids or for grown-ups? Kate talks to a psychologist about the time we spend with our technology and how to know when we need a break. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then swimming can be good for the mind, body, and soul. And when we can't swim, even spending time near water can be soothing and help us relax. We talked to an author about her book on human's attraction to water. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.